hdpodcast.com.
What large nails you have, she exclaimed. Don't look at them, he said. They are ugly. You mustn't say that. They are not ugly. They are very beautiful and so shiny. But why are they so big? Because, he said and halted. Because it's a disease.
A disease?
Yes.
What kind of a disease?
Let's look at your nails instead, he suggested. Like polished jewels. He put them to his mouth and kissed them. He felt tempted to nip her fingertips with his teeth, and he did so, but ever so gently. And yet he hurt her. She had wanted to exclaim and draw her fingers away, but she didn't. Was not this the way she could show her gratitude? She insisted.
Bite them if you want to.
And as he hesitated, she asked, Do you want to?
He wants to!
Boy, does he want to. I gotta say, this scene took me back to my dating days.
What?
The hours I would spend arguing with women. I want to look at your nails. No, let me look at your nails. You know, just on and on and on. So exhausting. Speaking of exhaustion, we are here to exhaust this book, The Werewolf of Paris by Guy Endor.
And we're here to do it on the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
At hppodcraft.com, I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey.
And our reader is once again the lovely, the talented, the willing, Erwan Marshall. Now, if you wound up here listening to this by accident, let me explain what's going on. This is the Untitled Werewolf Story Coverage Month. I've been trying to come up with cool names for the month, but man, nothing's working. Nobody's happy.
No.
I'm not even going to bother this week. Because like last week I said, how about Oops Werewolves?
Yeah.
Which sounded like a good idea. I mean, it was at least a try. It sounded kind of hip and cool.
Yeah.
But we got a letter that said Oops Werewolves. More like Poops Werewolves.
Oh, ouch.
I know.
Yeah.
Fine, make a joke. I want people to have a good time, but like, please don't get personal when you're writing these criticisms. That hurt.
Yeah. Well, people don't understand you're a sensitive artist.
Anyway, this book that we're reading, it's about a kid who was born on Christmas.
Yeah.
I think that's a pretty good summary.
That's it. There you go.
There you go. No, he grows up to discover that he's a werewolf.
Yeah.
And then he meets a girl who is masochistic and will allow him to abuse her. And that seems like it'll keep him from eating people. Maybe.
Maybe.
The werewolf is Bertrand. Bertrand, we've been saying, Bert, if you're his friend. His adopted father, Amar, is looking for him, but he's managed to disappear into the military. This is all taking place during the Franco-Prussian War mm-hmm. and its aftermath. The girl he's in love with is Sophie, the daughter of a wealthy fella. The wealthy fella approves of her working in this military canteen because it looks good for the family for her to be doing poor people work. She's being courted by an upstanding guy named Captain Brawl, but she's only got eyes for Bertrand because he feeds the darkness inside of her.
After their initial creepy, abusive encounter, Sophie starts visiting Bertrand often, not really keeping their relationship secret, and the captain figures out that his chances with her kind of done.
Yeah, not very good.
So this is cool. How Endor ties in the war of love with the actual war.
Yeah, and the war is getting crazier and more complicated. In the last episode, we talked briefly about how Napoleon III had surrendered to the Germans mm-hmm. right as Amar showed up in Paris. This was 1870. Now, Napoleon was initially an elected president, but then declared himself emperor. And now that he's beaten, that's the end of the Second French Empire that he declared. But the war is not over. A new government quickly forms and declares that they are the Third Republic. And the fighting with the Germans goes on for another 5 months, eventually leading to a siege of Paris. In January 1871, Paris falls, but there's another internal uprising called the Paris Commune. And these are communists. They seize power. They hold it for 2 months until the French army, under the control of the wealthy in exile at Versailles, they suppress these communists known as the Communards in a really bloody mm-hmm. fashion. I mean, something like 20,000 Communards were executed within 1 week.
Yeah.
And Guy Endor was sympathetic with communist causes. I think that's why his interests lie specifically in this period of French history and why this like last quarter of the book really gets bogged down in exclaiming how rough they were treated.
Yeah.
We simply don't have enough time to get into the nuances of all the history. We're just going to stick with plot as we talk about this. Yeah. But while I was reading the book, I went down a rabbit hole myself on a lot of this stuff. It really is fascinating. The Communards, I always thought, you know, that was like an 80s band. Oh, do you remember them?
Yeah, I do.
I had no idea that was an actual political movement. I don't know that Endor was super into the Communards. I think that he just thought there were a lot of lessons to learn from their failed experiment. There's this great line in the book. He says, the commune was a proletariat government, yes, but so is a hobo camp. The commune was never anything but the gnashing of teeth of men annoyed at their impotence and failure.
Wow.
But Amar wonders, maybe Bertrand, by being a werewolf, this kept coming up. Maybe he has infected society somehow, and he's causing all the bloodshed of the war.
Hmm.
Just by a werewolf showing up in Paris, that's what caused all this mayhem.
That's putting a lot on him.
It really is. I think... But he also wonders sometimes, well, in the face of all this mayhem and destruction, why is it a big deal that this guy's a werewolf? So he vacillates between those two points of view.
So things are getting pretty bad in Paris, and Sophie's parents are packing up and getting their stuff out, away from the danger. We find out that there is not a lot of love between Sophie's parents, though her father seems to care about her mother. The mother seems very bitter.
Yeah, well, the mother only has slept with the father once, and that's... the conception of Sophie, you know, that's the origin of Sophie. And the only reason she did it was because they were on a ship that they thought was going down. They thought they were going to die.
Oh, God.
And otherwise, he cheats on her constantly. She acknowledges in this conversation that she's a kept woman, basically. He pays for everything, but he's constantly cheating on her, so she won't touch him. But it's interesting that, like, Bertrand came from this act of rape, this act of violence. Mm-hmm. And Sophie, the masochist, comes from this act of desperation in the face of death. You know, everybody's kind of imprinted upon... by whatever the circumstances of their conception was.
Weird.
And the father, Baron de Blumenberg, he's this interesting character. The changing governments don't affect him because he's rich. So every new government that comes in, he just pays everybody off, including the communards. He gives them, these are supposedly not people who are interested in wealth, but he pays them $1 million and they say, we'll leave you alone. So that's why he's able to escape at this moment.
As a surprise to her father, Sophie has decided to stay in Paris. He thinks that it's because she's in love with the captain, which makes him kind of happy because he sees the captain as an upstanding guy, part of the community, all that stuff.
Which he kind of is. I don't think there's much wrong with him than he's jealous.
I mean, as jealous guys, he's not so bad, really.
He still writes her love notes.
Still writes her love notes and stuff. But her father sees Baron and says, hey, Sophie's got something she wants to tell you. So the captain, he gets all excited. So he's like, oh, is she going to actually start wanting to like really date me? Because right now they just hold hands and hang out. He's thinking maybe I'll get a kiss. Who knows? Fingers crossed. So the captain's unsure about this because he's pretty sure that she's with Bertrand.
Yeah.
He goes to her, unsure of what to do, and he finally asks her if it's true. After some bandying about, she tells him, yes, that she's in love with Bertrand. And the captain says, I'll kill him. And she says, if you kill him, you kill me. And he says that he doesn't care. And then Sophie zings him with this, oh, so you lied in all your letters so that your love for me is with conditions and rules? And he's just like, oh, damn.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's, of course not. I love her unconditionally. I have to mean that. Even though I guess I really don't because I'm really mad right now, but you're right. You know what? So whatever you do, I'm going to love you, he says to her. And she tells him, you know, that's really nice of you. We can be friends, but I'm really with Bertrand. He goes off. He wants some kind of revenge for this, but he's not sure how to go about it without hurting her because he doesn't want to hurt her because he actually does love her.
And what's up with her? She's keeping him in the friend zone there.
Yeah.
She's manipulated him into still doing nice stuff for her all the time.
Yes.
She should cut him loose. Sophie's not that great.
Well, God, she's really
She's going to do even worse stuff to him coming up. So yeah.
She does some really bad stuff later. So chapter 14, Amar has been in Paris for 8 months now and hasn't seen Bertrand. There hasn't been any obvious reports of wolf or dog attacks in the news lately. So Amar's wondering if Bertrand might have been killed with all the fighting going on. Now, the author goes off on a bunch of political stuff with the Catholic Church where people are kidnapped and ransomed and all these things are going on. A lot of detail about it.
Yeah.
Supposedly, that is the communards. They were saying that the church was doing a bunch of messed up stuff, saying that they found some crazy women locked up in an attic. There was all these bones and bodies buried. And there's this, supposedly one of the bodies was of this missing girl. And the priests were having sex with the nuns. And the nuns were getting abortions.
Yeah, and the nuns are like being kept up in these attic rooms. This chapter really explores these rumors.
But it's all BS. It's just propaganda against the church, who is probably just on the wrong side of this particular conflict.
Yeah.
The monks were arrested and used as leverage by the military to get support for the Vatican. Now that I just summed up a lot.
Yeah, it goes on for a long time. It's actually a pretty interesting chapter to read, but it doesn't have much to do with the central story. The whole reason, though, he brought up the crazy Catholic Church rumors was to set the scene. Under the commune, they had soldiers going to these churches, investigating possible abuses, digging bodies up to find out if they were aborted babies from these rape victims, etc. And this is the setting for where Amar finally sees Bertrand.
Amar sees all these soldiers carrying a coffin, and then he recognizes one of the soldiers as Bertrand. So he goes up behind Bertrand and he goes, appropriate work.
Yeah.
Bertrand's just sort of surprised and a little freaked out, but he doesn't make a scene or anything like that. And Amar is just very cutting with him. But Bertrand is behaving very remorsefully, but obviously not remorseful enough to turn himself in. Amar tells him about the farmhand who was accused of murdering Jacques Renault, who was acquitted, but killed himself because no one believed him.
Yeah, that guy.
He brings up the man who was accused of killing the general and aiding his dead daughter, how he was punished for that. So Bertrand seems very ashamed, bursting into tears. And then Amar actually feels really bad for him.
Amar had no plan here. I mean, it was like the only thing he planned was his cute remark, appropriate work. He goes, I put all of his energy into a quip. And then after that, you know, Bertrand cries a little and he goes, oh, all right, what am I going to do?
Well, Bertrand asks if his mother knows about him being a werewolf. And Amar goes, I don't think she knows. And then Bertrand wants to know how his mom's doing. So Amar says, I don't know how she's doing right now because there was a scandal back at home. She got pregnant. And she tried to rope this guy into being the father. The guy denied it, but then the two of them ran off together. Mm-hmm. And then after that, Bertrand looks really sad and he says that too. He's like, well, that's a strange reaction. And then he starts to think about things a bit and do a little math in his head. And he puts two and two together and gets rapist werewolf.
Oh, the worst kind of math.
And he realizes that Bertrand raped his mother and impregnated her. Bertrand says, I've been cured. He's found a way to control the beast and it is true love. Bertrand's going to meet her and he wants his uncle to see her, not to meet her. And Amar really wants it to be true because Bertrand never asked to be a werewolf. That's not a thing that he wanted to happen to him.
Yeah, he's got sympathy for him. We never find out what happens to his new baby with his mother.
No.
Hey, you know, this weekend I finally watched Curse of the Werewolf, the 1961 Hammer Films production of this.
So was it good?
You know, it was okay. It looked really pretty. It's a Hammer film, so it's slow. It's that weird thing that happens where, like, absolutely nothing is happening on the screen, but the music is like, bah, 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 you know, just so loud. The makeup's pretty cool. Oliver Reed turns into a werewolf at the end, and then it has this really anticlimactic ending where he just breaks out of a prison and starts doing parkour, basically. He's just, like, climbing on these rooftops. And all of these angry villagers show up out of nowhere. It's like they just came from the film set of Frankenstein next door or something. They just show up and they're mad at him. And then one of them throws a torch at him and it starts this bale of hay on fire. Uh-huh. And he throws the hay at them. And that's it. Like, and then they kill him. That's the whole movie.
Wow.
There's other stuff. You know, it's kind of interesting because they really try and do the background with the rape and they condense that into a couple. They take the stories and they kind of shove them together into one story. Uh-huh. But so the first half of the movie is really just the origin of the werewolf, which you never see. I can't imagine anybody making a movie now where the main character isn't in there in the first 10 minutes.
Yeah.
In this movie, he doesn't even show up until halfway through. And he also, when he turns into a werewolf, he strangles a lot of people. That was my favorite thing about it. Is when he, you know, he doesn't like rip them apart with his teeth. He just strangles them. Like, why does he have to turn into a werewolf to strangle someone?
Regular people can strangle people.
He might as well have used, you know, turned into a werewolf and had a revolver. You know, it would have been just as. But okay, I just want to say there's a great scene in there where the Amar character finds out that the kid is a werewolf. And it's because the priest just basically lays it on him. He's like, look, the kid's a werewolf. And the scene is so ridiculous. It goes on for it just in that the priest goes, he has all the information and he's sure of it. And the guy just accepts it. You know,
oh,
he goes,
right.
The kid's a werewolf. He'll always be a werewolf. The only thing you can do is he's got to have love in his life. And if you know what? If he meets a woman and they have true love, then maybe he won't be a werewolf. And the guy's just like, wow, he takes it, you know, like his kid's got, you know, juvenile diabetes or something. He's just like, well, okay, you know, we're going to have to work on this, you know?
Yeah, all right. Get him in treatment. Get him out on the dating circuit, you know?
Exactly.
Got to meet lots of girls because finding true love is pretty rough. But if you do the numbers,
tough,
you can find him.
They really did pull that out of the book because if he's got this true love, he's trying to express that to Amar in the scene. I have a woman now and I have true love, so that's what's keeping me from being a werewolf. It's got that Beauty and the Beast aspect.
Right. And that's what he says. But what it isn't really quite what he's selling.
No, that's right.
So Amar sees Bert run to Sophie, who seems, you know, pretty and lovely. And Captain Baral sees Amar looking at the two of them and asks Amar if he knows them. And basically, Baral and Amar realize that they both know about the other person that they're interested in. So they get together to share notes. But unfortunately, they're both so suspicious that they don't really get what they're after. And Amar only warns Baral that he's got to do something quick about Bertrand. So Baral goes to where he thinks that Sophie and Bert are shacked up, and he overhears them together, and it sickens him, and he just kind of runs off. Bert, what he's doing with Sophie is he gives her like these little cuts, and then he drinks her blood.
Yeah.
Which it seems more vampire than werewolf to me, but you know, whatever. But so she's getting sicker and sicker because she keeps giving him all this blood, and Bert suggests going out and maybe killing somebody to help him not have to drink so much from her to kill her. But she forbids it out of insane jealousy because she's the only one that can keep him alive and keep him pure. And he goes, but I'm going to kill you. And she goes, I don't care if I die. And I mean, you were right, dude. She is really goth AF. Like, seriously. But I have a question here. Are they having sex with each other? Because they don't say that they are. They sleep together. They sleep in the same bed and they cuddle. And he drinks her blood, like he wake up in the middle of the night and give her a little cut while she's sleeping and drink some of her blood. But is it the fact that she's a virgin? Like she's got virgin blood, so if he has sex with her, then she won't be a virgin and that wouldn't work?
It's pretty intense for a book written in 1933.
Yeah, it is.
He uncovered her. There was scarcely a portion of her body that had not one or more cuts on it. The older ones had healed to scars that traversed her skin with lines that were visibly lighter than the surrounding area. The newer ones were angry welts of red, or hard ridges of scab. In the candlelight, the latter were like old jewelry or polished tortoise shell. Suppressing a moment's hesitation, he bent over her body. The blood welled up, ruby red. He put his mouth to it at once and drank greedily. His lips made ugly, sucking noises as he strove to extract all the blood he could. Her fingers played with his hair, meanwhile. Poor little baby, she murmured. Now they were locked in each other's arms again. Sleep separated them at last. In the morning, when daylight woke them up, he was a different person. He looked with horror upon his deeds. With his fingertips, he touched her wounds and wept. I'm killing you, he moaned. What a fate. He slapped his brow with the palm of his hand, that hairy palm.
I think it's pretty strongly implied that they are sleeping together there. You know, now they were locked in each other's arms again. Sleep separated them at last. Between those two lines, I think, is the sex.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's just having some steady blood that in sex is basically keeping his beast at bay.
Yeah.
So chapter 16, Bertrand's blood drinking is, you know, really messing Sophie up. He worries about her, but she doesn't stand for it. She's just like, you got to do what you got to do. I've got to feed your darkness.
She's so into it.
Because my soul is black. He says if he's killed in the fighting, what is she going to do? And she's just like, well, I'm going to kill myself because you're the only reason I exist.
Wow.
And finally, one day she waits for Bertrand and he just never shows up. Turns out he got court-martialed for attacking another soldier. And that's why he wasn't able to be there. He bit him. So like full on wolfed out on the guy. Amar heard about this and decided he wanted to see what had happened. So he goes to see Bert in jail. Bertrand seems to have had enough. He's ready to die. He doesn't want Amar to tell Sophie where he is or what happened to him. And he feels he's hurt her enough that her life's been miserable. And he's just messed her, you know, like he's cutting her up and drinking her blood. And that, you know, it just can't be good for a person.
How long can that really be sustained?
Exactly. So Bertrand says to tell Francois and his mother goodbye. So Amar, though, feeling kind of bad for Bertrand, decides he wants to write up all the evidence about the condition of Bertrand, about, you know, his werewolfery.
Yes.
So now we understand the origin of this whole thing that we're reading.
Right. This is the testimony.
Right.
The whole document thus far has been this.
He leaves nothing out of his account and his ideas of how this could happen, and he turns them into the judge. The day of the trial, the judge seems to leave out all the supernatural facts, but he does quote Amar a bunch on the nature of man, and the sentencing is such.
Here is no self-interest seeking to oppress a people and hold it in subjection by means of enforced and cunningly inculcated ignorance and superstition. Here is progress, freedom, and intelligence. This court therefore agrees that inasmuch as the accused is suffering from an illness which leads him to go mad at times, that inasmuch as he shows by his present demeanor that his violence is only temporary, that inasmuch as this court tries only crimes and does not propose to cure disease by jail or execution, that this court therefore decrees that the accused be turned over to the infirmary at the prison of La Santé for treatment, and there be guarded until cured.
So he's sentenced to the madhouse.
Right. And I completely get that nobody believed this account from Amar. he's actually a werewolf.
Of course not. Why would anybody believe that? No, why would he think anybody would believe that?
But they take it as confirmation that this person is insane and needs to go to a facility that can handle that kind of thing. So at least it kind of helps steer him away from prison, but it's very ineffectual.
But just as the sentencing is wrapping up, something is going on outside. The Versailles troops are pouring into the city. The fighting is close and people are just kind of getting the hell out of there.
Yeah.
A lot of people are fleeing from the city, but some stay and fight for their hopeless cause. And that ends that chapter and gets us into 17. This now gives us an account of what happens in Paris at this time, and it's bad. Lots of people were captured, only to be executed later. This is the kind of stuff you were saying at the top of this episode. People are narking on their neighbors about threats real and perceived. People are getting arrested and executed.
There are a lot of small anecdotes threaded throughout this book that illustrate how paranoid people were. Just small things to really give you a feel of what was happening on the street during this conflict. But there was one I thought was weird. This is from back in chapter 12. It says, an old woman, about to commit an indiscretion ordinarily beyond her years, hung her torn skirt before her window to dim the light of her candle and guard herself against betrayal. But the strange configuration of light, as seen from the outside, collected a crowd on the street, who saw in this mixture of dots and dashes, where the light came through the torn garment, a secret code, a signal to admit the Prussians to Paris. Instead of keeping her shame a secret, the poor woman found her room invaded, and her sin the latest joke of the street. This is just purely for my edification. What was she doing?
I think she was having an affair, and so she put up her dress so that people couldn't peek in her window and find out who she was sleeping with. And then her skirt had like some weird holes in it, and it looked like they thought it was a code.
But it was the shame and the sin and the indiscretion I didn't understand, because there's no mention of another person, so I just thought, is she just masturbating?
Oh, geez. Maybe that was it.
And she's putting her skirt up. So that, you know, she can kind of hide it. It says an indiscretion ordinarily beyond her years. I don't know. That's how I took it. But now that you say she was having an affair, maybe.
I just assume she's having an affair because, she, you know, like older women don't, you would think, wouldn't take lovers.
Right.
But maybe. I don't know.
I'm really glad I called that out. That was an important thing for us to discuss. Let's please proceed.
But this time is terrible. People are forming mobs. Women are setting fires to buildings. And one of these women is Sophie.
Yes.
It says that she was asking around trying to figure out what happened to Bertrand, and no one knew. And since no one had seen him, they added his name to the list of the dead. So Sophie believed that Barral was to blame for Bertrand's death. And Sophie, in front of an angry mob of soldiers, calls Barral a traitor. And so they get all angry and they grab him and they beat the hell out of him and they put him on trial.
Yeah, I mean, it's terrible what she does to him. Really gets him savaged. He's definitely the James Marsden character in this book. I don't know what it is about that actor, but he always plays the really nice guy who wants to to be with the woman, but just gets crapped on through the whole movie. Well, I don't know what it is about
but
him.
He got
Superman Returns, yes, the X-Men, yeah. And even in Westworld, he's getting shot constantly. There's just something.
Oh, that's right.
That
yeah.
Poor
hey,
guy.
He got Liz Lemon.
He did get Liz.
All worked out for him. When this trial happens, I mean, he's a bloody pulp in front of this trial. The judges know that he didn't do anything wrong, that it was all a scam, but the world is so crazy and these people at this trial are so out for blood, they just kind of cop out. It says, they found him guilty only of negligence and ordered him merely degraded from his captaincy, but they specified that he should be sent to the nearest barricade and take his share of the fighting. One of the assessors added, if he shows sign of cowardice, bash his head in. They took him out and they just beat him to a pulp.
Ugh.
They left him for dead in a ditch. And this is all because Sophie blamed him for something that he didn't do.
Yeah.
Pretty much got him almost murdered here. But Sophie, she's nuts at this point. She's nuts with guilt, with anger. She wants to see Bertrand's body, but can't be found because he's not dead. But she doesn't know that.
Yeah.
She wants to die, but she just can't kill herself. She just doesn't have the will to do it. So Amar these days is just kind of keeping himself hidden away and watching the horrible mess unfold kind of from a distance.
Mm-hmm.
Atrocity after atrocity went on. Amar lists a few of them about the wrong people being killed for the wrong reasons. Even after discovering that they were wrong, the perpetrators of these crimes just don't care much.
Yeah, it's just blood is just running in the streets.
Just really shows how terrible everything is. It really kind of makes these crimes that Bertrand did pay.
Bertrand, it now seemed to Amar, was but a mild case. What was a werewolf who had killed a couple of prostitutes, who had dug up a few corpses compared with these bands of tigers slashing at each other with daily increasing ferocity? And they'll be worse, he said. Instead of thousands, future ages will kill millions. It will go on. The figures will rise and the process will accelerate. Hurrah for the race of werewolves.
So Amar sort of takes a delight in all the foolish people and the misery that they bring upon themselves.
Yeah.
Like he kind of feels he's above it and that he's predicted it. And he's like, yeah, I was right. You know, look at this. This is people. This is how things are. But then, you know, he gets arrested himself. When he gets arrested, he's being moved with many other prisoners out of town. At this point in history, some 40,000 people were prisoners.
Yeah.
When it was all said and done, that's how many people got moved out. 40,000 people.
Crazy.
And these are women and children as well, convicted of crimes against the state.
Right.
So on the march, the crowds attacked the prisoners, saying, "No prisoners, death to them all."
And Amar chuckled. "More werewolves," he exulted, oblivious of the blows that rained upon him. "The world is full of them. How is it that I once thought they were rare? I was one once myself and didn't know it."
They didn't know what to do with all these prisoners, just because there's so many of them. But many of them were going to be deported to colonies.
This chapter is just all brutality and madness. They talk about the firing of Paris. So as the communards are being shut down, they just burn monuments and art and treasures just to be cruel. I feel like in that last reading that we heard, that's really the end notion of the book.
Yeah.
We're all werewolves. But, you know, how could we think that these things are rare that rise up once in a generation? It's all these different things needed to happen for Bertrand to become a werewolf. But guess what? We all are. We were all born werewolves.
Yeah.
It's happening every day still, you know. I mean, I feel like this is kind of the last chapter of the book. We get it in the next chapter. It's a little more epilogue than anything.
So chapter 18, what happened to everybody? We find out that Sophie got implicated in the case with Beral, but he came to her trial limping with a withered arm and weeping out of one eye.
Uh-huh.
Because the other eye was dry and closed. It had been eaten by flies as he lay for dead in the ditch beside the barricades of Palace Voltaire.
Oh, God.
So that's the guy with you said there was a dude whose eye got eaten by flies.
Yep, it was him.
And it was Beryl.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
He was laying there all beat up, and then some flies got in and ate up on his eye. It's the worst.
God. So Sophie's father was able to get her out of being shipped off to New Caledonia with his money and his influence. She was free, but she still wanted to die and didn't, and still yet did not have the courage to do it.
Right.
So she took to drinking a bunch. And so I said she couldn't go to bed sober or alone. So she's pretty much sleeping with anyone.
Yeah.
And Beral is heartbroken because despite all this and all she did to him, he still cares about her. And he asks her why she slept with all those men. And her answer to that was to sleep with him.
Uh-huh.
His feelings for her were renewed. And after that sexual encounter, he asked her to marry him. And she's like, "I can't believe, you know, after everything I've done to you, you would do this and forgive me." And so she agrees. They're going to get married. They set the date for the next day. And it's this idea, this hopeful idea of a reunion that gives her the strength to kill herself.
Yes.
So that night, by gas, she does it. She does herself in.
This poor guy.
Oh, my God. Well, what's he thinking?
Yeah. That's true.
He needs a little self-respect, this guy.
You know, fool me once. You know, get me beaten in the trenches and flies eat out my eye. Shame on you, but promise to marry me and then commit suicide. Shame on me.
So Amar had to testify at the trial and managed to get released. Once released, he goes to visit Bertrand at La Sante. Bertrand hates being there, and they keep him locked up and away from his carnal desires. He begs Amar to get him out, to which Amar says, "Get you out? How can I? And do you think you ought to be out? Wolves belong in a cage in a zoological garden." So Amar asks if Bertrand ever thinks about Sophie, to which he says, "Sure, any woman for that matter," which is kind of callous.
Yeah.
So Amar asks Bertrand if he ever changes, to which he never really answers.
Yes.
You know, like, does he still change into a wolf? So Amar feels bad and pulls some strings to have him taken to a nice sanitarium run by this guy, Dr. Dumas.
Right, but this place turns out not to be so nice. And this is a really sad part of the end for Bertrand, because basically it's one of those places where they treat everybody there terribly, but then scrub them up and put on nice when their family comes to visit so they can make the money.
Right.
This is what they do to Bertrand. The doctor locks him up in an attic, you know, sort of prison. And he's kept there for years, tortured by an orderly. Next to him, there's a weird...
They call her mongoloid, which I assume he means somebody with Down syndrome.
Yeah, right. But she sings all the time and he starts to think of her as Sophie. That's Sophie over there singing. He's going crazy. And that's what brings us to his end.
He finally one day decides he's going to get out. So he jumps up to this really high window, busts through the bars, which weren't in very well. So he's able to get them out, goes into her room, and he finds that orderly raping who he believes is Sophie.
Yeah.
And he kills him. He rips him apart, and then he grabs a woman and he says, "Come, Sophie, let us die together." And they just jump out of the window. I mean, he throws down a mattress like that's going to stop them or something. Right. But they're up so high that he just totally splats into the ground.
Such a not dramatic end. He just gets put in this place and it's horrible. And then he jumps out the window because he's crazy and dies. Everything is sort of for no purpose.
So actually, Baral shows up. He's tracked down Bertrand. He's found out that he's alive and he wants to get kind of revenge on him for, you know, ruining Sophie. But when he gets there, he finds out he's dead. He's a week late. He says, "Death robs me of both my love and my hate. I'd like to dig you up, you dog, and spit in your face." And that's the end, except for the appendix, which talks about how between 1875 and 1880, they had to move some cemeteries around. One of those included the body of Bertrand, and the report said the following.
Among the bodies exhumed was one Bertrand, cerebral hemorrhage, died August 9, 1873, buried August 10, 1873, exhumed June 10, 1881. Length of inhumation, 8 years, 2 months. The following case is reported to the conservateur of the cemetery, and by him forwarded to the Department of Criminal Justice. Evidently a case of grave robbery, or a grim prank of the grave diggers. The body was not found in the coffin, instead that of a dog, which despite 8 years in the ground was still incompletely destroyed. The fleshy parts and the furry hide were found mingled in a fatty mass of indistinguishable composition. A nauseous odor spreads from the body. No insects.
That is the end of The Werewolf of Paris.
That is the end of it. Hey, you know, in that movie adaptation, what I liked is when the werewolf did get shot, he didn't turn back into the person. He was just still a werewolf laying there.
Oh, whoa, okay.
Usually they do the, you know, crossfade to humanity, but that didn't happen. And in here, he's a dog in the grave.
Yeah, it's really weird. There's one of the things that sort of sticks in my craw, but I'm not really sure if it's my perception of it or if it was intended, but there seems to be a bit of misogyny going on.
Uh-huh.
You know, with his mother and her kind of willingness to be raped by her son.
Uh-huh.
And then Sophie's willingness to like just kind of give up everything in her life for this tortured soul. Do all these really depraved things just to please him. Like, there aren't any strong female characters necessarily. I mean, his aunt, I guess, the matriarch of the family.
Sort of.
She knew what was going on. And
well, but then she's a superstitious fool, too.
Yeah. So I don't think it represents.
And of course, you know, the girl's 17. They're always 17.
Oh, right. Yeah.
You know, and perfect, unspoiled. Yeah. No, definitely there's that going on. Yeah. The female characters suck in this book.
And that sort of bothered me, and of course they're vehicles for the men's desires, really. That I don't like about it. It's really depressing.
Yeah,
because it's kind of interesting and it's really dirty and screwed up stuff happens. Like, this is definitely, like I said it before, this is the bawdiest story that we've ever covered on the show,
for sure. You know, it's a good book. I definitely think it's worth a read. It's interesting.
Oh yeah,
it's full of interesting stuff, and the situations are uncomfortable, and it addresses some weird things. And despite its shortcomings, I think it's definitely worth a read. I'm glad we covered it. This last quarter is a little ponderous, I gotta admit. I mean, what we flew through, you know, was like the last 30% of the book in this episode, and it gets a little heavy.
Yeah.
I still read it, you know, I still gobbled it up, but I wished there was a more dramatic end for these main characters.
Yeah.
Instead, they just sort of run off to unremarkable ends, which I guess is probably the point.
Yeah.
What he's trying to get across.
Yeah, that's not some big dramatic town with pitchforks and torches chasing him down and having
a There's no werewolf parkour at the end at all. That's what I've come to there's two things I want in a werewolf movie. It's strangling and parkour. If I don't get that, how do I even know it's a werewolf movie?
How do you know?
Just how do you know that's what you're watching?
That wraps up what we once called Werewolf History Month.
Yes, the as of still unnamed Werewolf Content Month is concluding. Hey, next month we're going to do some more Walter de la Mare.
Yeah, I love that guy.
Specifically, we're going to start off November with a story called All Hallows.
Appropriate.
Which I think is appropriate. So that's what we've got coming up next, All Hallows by Walter de la Mare. Thanks, everybody, for sticking with us as we cover The Werewolf of Paris. I especially want to thank Erwan G. Marshall for being our reader.
Oh, thank you so much, dude. You kick ass.
He's a trooper. He did great work. That's all we've got for this week. Thanks. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
At hppodcraft.com.
hppodcraft.com.